wrote on logic. He wrote on rhetoric. He wrote on poetics. He wrote on politics. He divides these things up, observes them closely, understands the rules by which each one operates, understands the vocabulary that attaches to each one of them. So you see, no chairness, no shoeness. Let's look at shoes. Let's look at chairs. That's the difference here. He believed that the communication of what is known or knowable depends on careful description. Now, Aristotelian description can be one of the most complicated elements of his philosophy, or actually one of the simplest. He developed 10 categories. And what he basically says is that these categories are elements of the description of anything that exists. What do I have in mind? Substance, quantity, quality, relation, location, time, position, condition, action, and affection. I won't repeat that long list. I don't expect you to remember it. But what I will invite you to think about is Aristotle's mania for describing things precisely. He laid down the rules for syllogisms, the most elementary tools of logic. How do you actually demonstrate that something is true? How do you prove that something is not true? Indeed, in classifying syllogisms, all men are mortal. Socrates is a man. Socrates is mortal. That syllogism works. He thinks that syllogisms communicate knowledge. And what he does, basically, is study several, over 200 of these, and finds in the end that there's only about 24 that are actually valid. Now, Aristotle also has had to think about these large problems that have been plaguing his contemporaries for a long time. He's worried, for instance, about causation. What makes things enter on the processes which look like change to others? Now, the French scholar Pierre Pellegrin describes Aristotelian causation theory this way. Let me just quote a very brief line from him. There are four ways in which something is said to be responsible for something else. In one sense, the responsible element in the statue is the bronze from which it is made. In another sense, a certain numerical relation is responsible for the octave. In still another sense, the one who has promulgated a decree is responsible for it. Finally, the health I would like to recover, he says, is responsible for the fact that I waste my time at sports. There are four causes at work in nature. Taken in the above examples, these are the material, the formal, the efficient, and the final. What Aristotle is able to do is lay out a series of explanations for what looked to others like change, for what looked to others like motion. In the process of all of this, Aristotle, and we may perhaps leave him with this notion, said that the virtue of a shoemaker is to make a good shoe, not to know what a shoe is. Now, there are certain modern designers who would do well to go to school on that proposition. In Raphael's great painting of the School of Athens, in a sense a comment on all of Western thought, Plato points up, reality is there, beyond us someplace. Aristotle points, perhaps straight out, perhaps down a bit. No, reality is here, in our midst. And this has been not a parting of the ways, but the two paths along which the quest of knowledge has proceeded for 2,500 years, thanks to a process that began on the Ionian coast.
Lecture 14, The Failure of the Polis and the Rise of Alexander.
Hello again, and welcome to lecture number 14 in our series on the foundations of Western civilization. Over the last several lectures, we talked various ways and from various points of view about the Greek polis. We talked about it as a political and social institution in connection with Athens and Sparta. We talked about its public arts, drama, architecture, for example. We talked about history as a way in which the polis reflected on itself and carried on conversations with itself. And then we talked about the philosophical culture that emerged in these remarkable Greek cities. Now we have a less happy task. We must dismantle the polis. Or actually, to be more accurate, we must watch the Greeks dismantling their own polis. For in the end, the polis failed. As we move along, we'll have one or two reflections on why that would have been the case, and why perhaps it's important that that was the case. Suffice it to say for the moment, by way of introduction, that the 4th century, the period after the Peloponnesian Wars, was an extremely difficult period for the Greek world. Eventually, the Greek world fell to the Macedonians to the north. But difficulties were not unprecedented. Difficulties did not arise in the 4th century for the first time. We could go all the way back, for example, to the time of the Persian Wars. There were very, very sharp differences, depending on where you lived in Greece, as to what your views were on the proper strategies to be deployed in fighting the Persians. If you lived far to the north, you wanted the defense lines there. If you lived far to the south, you wanted the defense lines there. And there were some people who took one look around and Medized, went over to the Persians. They thought, these guys are going to win. We better get on the winning side right away. Well, they obviously were treated rather harshly when, in fact, the Greeks won. During the Peloponnesian Wars, which followed a generation after the Persian Wars, most of the Greek world was dragged into the battle. Athens and her empire on the one hand, Sparta and her Peloponnesian League on the other hand, fought a long and brutal